Welcome to the February edition of the ISB Update podcast. My name is Mark Byatt from the IFRS Foundation, and today I'm joined by ISB Chair Hans Hoogervorst and Vice Chair Sue Lloyd. I'm going to be running through developments following the February board meeting. We'll start by looking at two projects that fall under the board's disclosure initiative before we dive into the decisions taken on those projects. Hans, perhaps you could remind us what the disclosure initiative is all about.
Yeah, so the disclosure initiative has been going on for a couple of years, and it's part of the board's plan to promote better communication in financial reporting. This came about for three reasons. Firstly, the feeling of many investors that there is not enough relevant information and perhaps too much irrelevant information. And finally, that often the communication of this information is ineffective. And what we did this month is to discuss two of the disclosure initiative projects in detail. First of all, accounting policies, and secondly, targeted standards level review of disclosures. It's also worth mentioning that the subsidiaries that are SMEs project, which was discussed in detail in the January podcast, also falls under the disclosure initiative.
Okay, thanks, Hans. So let's turn our attention to the first of the projects you mentioned, accounting policies. Sue, perhaps you could highlight what was discussed at this month's meeting and what decisions were made.
Okay, sure. So the accounting policies part of the disclosure initiative is looking at improving the disclosures provided in financial statements about accounting policy disclosures, because we've heard quite some frustration about them being too long and often being very boilerplate, so not very entity specific. So we put out an ED last year, and at this meeting, the staff presented the board with an analysis of the feedback we got in the comment letters on that exposure draft. And overall, respondents supported the main proposals, which were to require companies to disclose their material accounting policies rather than their significant accounting policies. And also there was a broad support for including some new examples in the IFRS practice statement on the concept of materiality to describe how to apply the concept of materiality when deciding what accounting policies there should be disclosures provided about. So this was very much a sort of an update meeting. The board wasn't asked to make any decisions, and the staff was really asking the board which parts of the comments that we received would we like to look at in more detail when we follow on with the discussions of the feedback we've received.
Great, thank you. So the board also heard an update on the targeted standards level review of disclosures. What were the key developments there?
So again, part of the disclosure initiative and looking at trying to improve the usefulness of disclosures by improving the way we draft our disclosure requirements in a couple of standards. So the staff have been testing a draft approach to guidance using the requirements in IAS 19, the employee benefits standard, and IFRS 13, the fair value measurement standard. So at this meeting, we discussed a very specific staff proposal about a reconciliation of movements in level 3 fair value measurements. And also we decided that the staff should update our guidance that we've prepared for our own use internally to reflect the developments we've made over the course of the project to date. So we're getting closer now to moving towards the drafting of the exposure drafts on this part of the project.
Great, thank you. So moving away from the disclosure initiative, let's look at other projects discussed at the February meeting. Sue, perhaps we could stay with you to provide an update on the business combinations under common control.
Okay, so just to remind people, this is a project all about developing requirements for how you have to account for a business combination which occurs within a group, so where the ultimate parent hasn't changed. And we're trying to improve comparability and transparency because at the moment we don't have specific requirements under IFRS and there's some frustration that people are doing different things. So we've already decided at our previous meetings what we're going to propose in terms of who should use the acquisition method and who should use the predecessor approach. And so what we were talking about this month was the disclosures that would be required for those two different methods. And broadly speaking, what the board has decided is that the disclosures that are required if you do a sort of normal business combination, if you like, under IFRS 3, those disclosures would apply, both the ones set out in IFRS 3 and the relevant proposals in our upcoming discussion paper on goodwill and impairment. And if somebody is applying the predecessor approach, that a subset of those disclosures would be required. We talked quite a lot about how specific it should be, and the board agreed with the staff's recommendation, which is really to use the objectives that we've got in IFRS 3 and in the discussion paper, but to provide some additional guidance to explain what sort of information that might be relevant because it's a BCUCC. It was also an important meeting because we finally agreed on what the form of the due process document will be that we put out for comment. The board agreed that it should be a discussion paper, and we gave the staff permission to proceed with preparing that document for publication.
Great, thank you. So that consultation document is expected to be published around mid-year, and we'll keep you updated on progress in future episodes of this podcast and on the website ifrs.org. Okay, well, let's turn to another important project, IFRS 17. The most recent IFRS 17 podcast is live on our website and our YouTube channel, and it goes into a lot more detail. But Hans, perhaps you could provide us with a high-level overview of what was discussed this month regarding the proposed amendments to IFRS 17.
Yeah, so this is all about our new standard for insurance contracts. And this month we concluded our planned technical discussions on the amendments that we exposed for public consultation in June 2019. And it's important to state that we are still on schedule. It was a very tight schedule, but we have been able to stick to our deadlines so that people can go on and get on with it. We have confirmed most of the proposals exposed for public consultation in June 2019 with some changes to address feedback. And the most important decision this time was an issue where we had proposed no amendment, which is the level of aggregation. As people will recall, we require normally for all contracts that they should be grouped no further than 1 year apart. This is the annual cohort. This is very important because without it, the investor would not be able to properly see on a timely basis the development of the profitability, the financial performance of an insurance company. Now, there were a lot of insurers who had asked for an exception for highly mutualized contracts. And in itself, that request was understandable because we accept that annual cohorts may provide less information on profitability trends and on new contracts becoming onerous, because in highly mutualized contracts, there is a lot of cross-subsidization between generations of contracts. Still, we decided to not create an exception. And why did we decide to take that decision? Well, first of all, if you look at the financial crisis in 2008, it is extremely important that accounting standards in general hold up very well under stress. And that was, for example, not the case with the incurred loss model. And that's why we needed to change that standard. It's also important to realize that the insurers are under a lot of stress right now due to the low interest rate environment. For example, it will always be very important for insurers to be able to buy bonds. Right now, they, because of the negative interest rates, they often make a loss the minute that they buy these bonds. An insurer has told me, I do not know what to do with my money that's coming in through premiums. I've also been told by an insurer association in an important country that a certain type of contracts are all onerous from the beginning if they were not to be subsidized by old contracts. So there is a lot of stress in the system, and we have to be absolutely sure that if we create an exception for such contracts, that they hold up well under stress. And we are not convinced of that. There are very few contracts that are 100% mutualized. There are a lot of mutualized contracts that have an exception for guarantees, for example. And we have just simply not been able to find a robust principle to create such an exception. Then you often have to resort to very clear rules, but very clear rules are easy to circumvent and create a very artificial standard, arbitrary standard. And that would be challenged in practice, and it would be highly susceptible to structuring, especially in a climate in which a lot of companies are under stress. So that's why we decided to take no risk and to remain with the decision as it is. We acknowledge that that may create some extra costs for a certain time of products, but we think those costs are smaller than the risks involved in creating an exception that might not hold up well under the stress of a crisis. So that's where we are. We are convinced we took the right decision. We are also convinced, even if we had taken another year to look at, to try to find a principle, where we would not have found it.
Okay. Clearly a very important project and an important board meeting. Sue, perhaps we could turn to another important project, which is the phase two of IBOR.
Sure. So just to remind people, phase two is dealing with situations where companies are now making amendments to their financial instruments and also amendments to their hedging relationships as a result of changes to benchmark interest rates around the world. And what we're trying to make sure is that there's useful information provided about this process in the financial statements, that there's not sort of unnecessary disruption in accounting. And also we're trying to provide some support for preparers as they modify their contracts. So I'll focus on a couple of specific decisions that the board made at this meeting. Firstly, the board at previous meetings have agreed to propose an amendment so that if a interest rate or is calculated in a different way, but the words in a contract are not changed, that that would also be considered a modification of the contract for accounting purposes. We had proposed to make that amendment for all such changes in calculation, but at this meeting the board agreed that we would limit the effect of this amendment to changes arising from IBOR reform at this point in time, and we'll come back later and look at the broader amendment. That's just to keep us focused given the timing pressure on this part of the project. We also looked at one very particular relief from the hedge accounting requirements, and we agreed to propose a change so that entities can designate new hedging relationships as long as they reasonably expect that new risk-free rates can be separately identifiable within 24 months and as long as they are reliably measurable. So that's an additional relief that we will propose. We also agreed to propose that the changes that we're making to IAS 39 and IFRS 9 will be mandatory rather than voluntary. And also we talked about how long these changes would last. So people who have been watching this project will know that we put a sort of official end date on the changes for phase one. We decided we didn't need to do this for phase two per se, and that's because people will apply the amendments to changes in their contracts and changes in their hedging relationships only as long as those changes arise directly from IBOR reform. So that's got a sort of natural termination date anyway. We also spoke about the effective date and transition requirements. And I think importantly for everybody who's watching this project, it was the end of the phase two discussions at the February meeting. So the board also agreed on a 45-day comment period and gave the staff permission to move on to the drafting process for this exposure draft.
Excellent. Thank you. That's obviously an important consultation to look out for. So I think that's pretty much it. Hans-Sue, thank you for joining me today. The full summary of the board's discussion and decisions at the February meeting can be found in the ISB update on the IFRS Foundation's website. If anyone listening has any feedback or suggestions about these podcasts, then please email communications@ifrs.org. Until next time, thank you for listening.